Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is being recorded in late August 2022. The global carbon dioxide level today is 416.35 parts per million, and there are 2,689 days left until the year 2030. The clock keeps ticking. Well, as you probably know, climate change is an enormous issue. You talk about climate change, think about world peace, big issues that seem intractable, seem far removed from the individual level. But in fact, the solution to climate change and the engine that will drive our work on climate change comes from people, individual people pressing for action. But the big question is, what as an individual can you do? I mean, where do you begin to think about climate change and your role in addressing it? Well, in order to talk about that, we have the pleasure of speaking with a couple of authors of a new book called The Big Fix, Seven Practical Steps to Save Our Planet. And those two gentlemen are, first of all, Mr. Hal Harvey, who is the chief executive at a company called Energy Innovation, a nonpartisan climate policy firm, where he's been thinking about this stuff for a long time. He's an engineer by training. He's gotten UN climate awards. He knows what he's talking about. Our other guest is Justin Gillis, who knows what he's talking about equally well. He's an award-winning journalist, has worked with the New York Times, the Post, the Miami Herald, et cetera, et cetera. Two guys who know a lot about the issue of climate change, the history of climate change, and what ways we should be thinking about climate change, what the issues are, in order to take practical personal action. So, Hal, Justin, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you
for having us.
Well, it's great to have you both here. So I just gave a little description of your new book called The Big Fix. Did I get it more or less right, or how would you I guess the question is, why did you write the book? Hal, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I'll take a quick stab at that. This is a big problem, as you properly noticed, Ted. And if you face a huge problem without ways to sort out what matters and what you can influence, then despair is the likely outcome. We can't afford despair. We need action, but it's got to be the right action. So we wrote the book to dig into who really makes the decisions about our climate future, especially in the energy sphere. And what can they do, the people who make these decisions, do to rapidly decarbonize their sectors or the economy? And how can individual citizens or small groups of people cause that to happen? So in a sense, it's all about understanding the secret levers that control carbon emissions and understanding with some detail what you can do to pull those levers. It's about focus in your choices.
So, Justin, what are those levers? What are the areas that people should know about in this context?
Yeah, let us give you some examples. And I'll preface this by saying a lot of people, you know, really care about this problem. They understand that it's an enormous issue. They understand that we're sort of wrecking the planet for future generations. They would like to help, but they feel, as Hal said, you know, kind of really overwhelmed by it. And so what a lot of people do is they say to themselves, well, this is so big, there's not much I can do, but I do at least have control of, you know, my own life. So I'm going to, you know, maybe I'm going to drive a smaller car. I'm going to recycle more diligently. I'm going to, you know, maybe I'm going to change my diet some to try to cut down on the emissions, you know, from the food I eat and things like that. So people tend to see this through the lens of being what we call a green consumer. What's really needed urgently is for people to kind of make a transition. So the green consumer thing is fine. It's helpful, but it's not enough. And so we all need to make this transition into being green citizens. And that's what Hal and I are fundamentally in the book trying to point people toward, is what does citizenship look like in this context? Now, you might think, Well, that means, you know, writing a letter to your congressman or, you know, complaining to your senator in Washington, also good things to do. But it turns out there's a whole bunch of levers that aren't in Washington and aren't under the control of your senator or under the control of your president. There's a whole lot of levers that are under the control of your state government, for example. There are other levers that are under the control of the city or the county where you might live. We call these secret levers in the book only because, I mean, there's nothing intrinsically secret about them. They're not state secrets. It's just that no one really knows they exist. So here's an example. Many people have noticed that some states have a lot of electric car models on the market. Other states, they're very scarce and hard to find. And they don't know why that might be. Well, the answer is State A has adopted California's emission standards, which order car companies to put low emission vehicles on the market, and State B has not. So whether your state has done that, and in some of these states, the governor has the power to do it without even going to the legislature, but whether your state has done that helps determine what kind of cars you're able to buy. People are kind of amazed when they learn that, but it's true. There's a bunch of other examples where, we're still building crappy buildings all over the United States. We are still putting, you know, gas heat and gas cooking into buildings, knowing that in 10 or 15 years, if not sooner, those gas lines are going to need to be shut down if we're going to meet our climate goals.
Right.
And so, that's really under the control of the town. The town decides what's allowed to be built. It passes the building codes. And I know right here in Massachusetts, you guys are having a fight right now about this, you know, where a bunch of towns want to move forward with sort of no gas in their new buildings. These are just a couple of examples of a whole, there's a whole battlefield out there that where we need to fight, you know, case by case, issue by issue. Much of it is local and state, and people just don't know that these fights are even going on. So we need them to learn, and we need them to engage with us in the battle.
In some sense, you're saying knowledge is power, and that if, once you find these things out, you're demystifying some aspects of how to address climate change, right? I mean, you're right. Here in Massachusetts, of course, there's the bill that was just passed encourages the ownership of electric vehicles through various kinds of things. And that's not necessarily true in all states. And a place that that's just one example. I mean, I know, as you mentioned here in Massachusetts, there are efforts to pilot towns not using gas in new construction. But that follows, I think, out in California, Berkeley was the first place to have done that. Right. And so there's lessons to be learned back and forth. I mean, do you see what sort of local action do you think is the most important between, is it a town based? So Massachusetts, we have mostly towns, right? Town meeting where everybody gets in a room and makes a decision for the next year, sort of, you know, authentic democracy. Other places have different structures. What level do you think is the most effective to work at? State, county, or local?
Let's let Hal talk about this, and because I think the answer, and I think he agrees, is who controls your electricity system and how those decisions get made. So, Hal, I'll throw that question to you.
Sure thing. So every month, almost everyone in America writes a check to their local utility, $130 or whatever the number is. And this adds up to hundreds of billions of dollars a year. So the question is, does that money land on wind and solar, or does it land on coal and natural gas? And who decides that question? In general, the answer to that question is the Public Utilities Commission. Every state has one. They have either 3 or 5 members, typically. Most of them are appointed by the governor, and they have a charge to deliver reliable, affordable, and in many cases, clean energy. So how do they decide whether your money goes to coal or natural gas on the one hand, or wind and solar on the other hand? They act like a courtroom. They have hearings. They take evidence. They do math. They have special judges called administrative law judges who work on this stuff full time. And they have regularly scheduled hearings to which the public is invited. Remember, Public Utilities Commission, the first word is public. So if you focus on how you influence their decisions, then you're going to steer tens or hundreds of billions of dollars from dirty choices to clean choices. And they more or less offer you an owner's manual on how to intervene. Their schedules time for comments. One of the things that, to answer your question more generally, one of the things that really matters, Ted, is to focus enough that you become a bit of an expert on a topic. So it's not that electric cars are more important than heat pump stoves or that they're more important than solar and wind electricity. It's which of these things do you want to tangle with? Which ones do you want to get involved with? You better choose one that's big and important. And that's what our book is about, identifying those that are big. And you better choose an intervention method that's likely to make a difference. It doesn't mean you have to become a utility regulatory lawyer. Let's say you have a child with asthma. Bring that child to the hearing and explain how epidemiology shows being downwind of a power plant exacerbates asthma. But the point is, the Public Utilities Commission is a perfect example of a maximum leverage venue where with a modest amount of focus, a lot of focus and a modest amount of research, you can have a signal difference. That's the kind of thing we got to do. Sorry.
Let me, again, in the Massachusetts perspective, let me put that into a specific thing that I am familiar with. So Massachusetts is part of New England, which is six tiny states all packed into the upper right-hand corner of the country, right? Many of the decisions about the power grid are regional. So it's an interesting extent. You've got local, county, state, and regional, as well as the federal. Here in this area, there's something called ISO New England, ISO, Independent Systems Operator. They metaphorically own the grid, and they make decisions. And they seem like an opaque, sphinx-like organization that just decrees things. But recently, MCAN, the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, has applied to be one of the members of something called NE Pool, New England Power Pool, right, which is an advisor to ISO. And it's a way that local grassroots activists can support and actually get a voice into those rooms where these big decisions are made. Because you're correct, there's a Public Utility Commission where people in Massachusetts can go to complain. And there's also this regional thing where you get a huge payoff for being present. So I hear what you're saying about being in front of the DPU, et cetera. What do you
Massachusetts
call it?
It depends on the state, but Massachusetts actually pioneered many of these instances back in the 90s with the New England Power Pool and the state public utilities commissions. And there was formed an important nonprofit organization called NESCOM, the Northeast States Air Management
Committee on Group. Electricity. Yes.
Yeah. So that's a get together of all the germane or most of the germane regulators, the air regulators. They are a public nonprofit organization. They will listen to you. They're fighting the hard fight. They will tell you, we're having trouble with the such and such a governor. Help us flip him or flip her. They can do a lot of the homework for you. They've done the homework to tell you where the intervention point happens to be. But the point of our book is that you have to do the research. You have to do some homework to figure out where the best intervention point is. And we organize those according to the ones that are going to have the biggest impact, because this is a scale problem. And then having done that, we spend some time talking about what makes them tick. What levers are there? How do you get to them? They're a little, the New England Power Pool, the ISO, the Independent System Operator, they're not used to the public intervening in their business. They're not used to hearing public comments. Yes. So let's get them used to it. Let's demand that they meet the climate goals of the region. Let's have the governor make a key phone call to the head of the ISO. There's a lot we can do.
I guess what I think the through line here, though, is that you guys are identifying how individual local efforts by people, just people, can resonate at these very high levels of Iceland and Leland and the State Utility Commission by basically learning a little bit, right? There's the old saying about it, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, right? So if you start studying this stuff, all of a sudden you will become an expert and a leader, right? Maybe not to challenge the expertise of the Public Utility Commission, but you can make yourself familiar. I think that's tell me, is that the point of your book, to give people the background for how to approach these issues and what the leverage points are? But I guess one of the things I've always made the case is that you should not feel obliged as a climate activist to march off and tilt at the windmill of the Public Utility Commission in your state. There may be something else that resonates more strongly with your interest. So I guess one question is, you've talked about the lever points. We focus for a moment on the electricity generation. What are the other kinds of issues that are important? I think you talk about, you know, food, getting off fossil fuels, building codes, things like that. What are the kinds of issues that people might find their internal resonance with and say, gee, I want to learn, focus on that part a little bit?
Let me give you an example that's sort of live right now, and especially so since the new climate bill passed in Washington this summer. Every day during the school year, millions of American parents put their children onto dirty diesel school buses to ride to school. Those buses are, of course, contributing to the greenhouse gas emissions that are going to wreck the planet that those children are going to have to live on when they grow up. Many of those, I don't know if you grew up riding on a school bus, Ted, but I did. And, you know, in the summer, the kids would open the windows and, you know, diesel fume, you know, you're idling there in the bus parking lot and diesel fumes are blowing in on you, you know. This is bad. I mean, it was the only thing we had for a long time, but now we have the possibility of electric school buses. They are more expensive up front, but the operating cost is so much lower that if you do the financing right, you can sort of even that out. Mm-hmm. You know, China they are millions and millions and millions of buses into a conversion to electric buses. Entire cities in China have already been converted to electric buses. Right. Here in the United States, we are still dragging our feet. We have not done it yet. It was big news when one jurisdiction in Maryland, Montgomery County, decided to order 200 electric school buses, and they committed to going completely electric over a period of a few years. My question is, why isn't every parent in America going down to the school board and saying, excuse me, why are we this year buying dirty diesel school buses? Why aren't we getting ready to make this conversion? That's something close to where people live. And I bet you 99.99% of parents out there are not even thinking about it, you know, or not even imagined going down. But how many people would it take? You know, 20, right. 30, 50 people, you know, going to a couple of meetings, and I think you'd get their attention, right?
So, and I think that's an example of the sort of resonance issue, entry point, I guess I would call it, for someone who may not think that they're a climate activist, but when the penny drops and they say, oh, my kid's breathing in these noxious fumes from the diesel bus that was we all idle, you know, that all of a sudden makes a change. And that's a place that you can use to begin to think about climate issues in a bigger way. So I agree. Yeah. I mean, that's Massachusetts has just passed a bill. There's a big climate bill that sort of parallels the federal bill, but in that bill is at least a study to begin to get public schools off of fossil fuels as a heating source. Right? Because the argument is that you're running natural gas pipelines into the schools and those pipelines are all leaking and it's all bad. The schools are a great place to have heat pumps. So that's kind of a parallel thing to the electric school bus. But again, it's a very personal place where this stuff touches you and gives you a reason to focus and learn more about it.
Oh, it's worse than that. I mean, many schools leave lights on all night for no good reason, right? They have not put in occupancy sensors on their lights. And, you know, the school buildings themselves, you know, across America still need to be retrofitted to cut the energy use. So, yeah, this stuff is not all. Our point is this is not all in Washington, right? It's not all in you know, the United Nations. It's not all in Paris or Berlin. It's not all up in the Arctic. You know, decisions to perpetuate the fossil fuel economy are being made every single day in local governments where you live. And very few people still are speaking up and saying, excuse me, can we do this differently? That's where we need to get to.
And so the question comes is what's your analysis as to why more people don't speak up? Is it the idea that we're all in some sort of common trance that we can't sort of snap out of? We can't see the stuff in front of our face? Is it conspiracy theories from the fossil fuel industry that sort of hides the bad effects of things? Or is it just that too many people are too overburdened just living their lives? I mean, why don't people recognize this more easily?
Well, this also gets to why we wrote the book. I mean, when you think about climate change and start to study it, or just pay attention to the news articles that are out there, it begins to seem intractable, just a wall of problems, droughts and floods and epic forest fires and stunted crops and everything else. And then you can turn around the solutions.
The Rhine River running dry in Germany.
Right? Yeah, and the Po is dry and so forth, the Loire River. And then you look at solutions and everybody's got one, from no more plastic straws to buy an electric car to nuclear power will solve everything. So when you're confronted with a wall of problems and a wall of undifferentiated potential solutions, the result is paralysis or sort of a generic call for help or for abatement. I mean, there are a lot of really smart, concerned, capable citizens who want to do something about climate change. But if you don't have a map or a guidebook, and it is complex, I mean, we're talking about revamping our grid and our transportation system and the design ultimately of our cities and the way we build buildings and our industrial processes. That's big stuff. It's the physical stuff in the economy has to be changed. So what we've done with this book is outline the stuff that really matters and the policies that really work. I say what matters and what works. And then what Justin hasn't mentioned yet, but which is crucially important, is the book is organized around these core topics, but it's told with stories, real world stories of people who have stuck their necks out and used their imagination and spent some time and actually made a huge difference. And they're ordinary people. They're not necessarily PhD scientists. Mm-hmm. So demystifying, unpacking, rethinking, targeting, that's what the book does, but then it does it with stories, I think.
Yeah, I do. It's crucial to get across here, Ted, that when we were talking earlier, I was getting a little worried that we were, you know, telling people they had to become sort of experts in these topics. And, you know, expertise is good. We're all for people learning as much as they can, but you don't need to become a super duper expert to make a difference, right? Even on something as complicated as, you know, what the grid's going to look like, just showing up at a meeting and saying, I support clean energy. And by the way, my daughter has asthma and, you know, we don't want, you know, coal burning power plants, you know, around us anymore. You know, that all makes a difference. I mean, the tragedy is these decisions are being made in the name of the public in all these different venues that we're talking about. And yet the public is rarely there, you know, and sort of speaking up. And, so what I would say is, you know, there's kind of room for everybody. I mean, we, you know, as many people as can become, you know, real experts in this stuff, we're all for that. But we also want people who don't have time for that to sort of raise their hands and be willing to say, I'm sorry, I want clean school buses in my, you know, in my school district. And, you know, that's just not a very complicated issue, right? Going from sort of, you know, dirty to clean. And so,
and the analogy, Justin, the analogy I have it sometimes uses the idea back in the days of the Apollo space mission, which is now sort of fewer and fewer people remember, but you didn't need to know technically how the Apollo rocket was going to work, the details of the rocket, in order to be excited about sending a person to the moon and supporting that, right? The same is true now, that you don't need to be an expert on grid issues to stand up and say, I want a clean grid. I mean, those are two completely different things. So I guess I second your point entirely, and that is even doubly important to, I think the secret that you guys are pursuing in the book is to give people enough knowledge to care and to see that their action is worthwhile. Even that simple action is worthwhile, and that's a good, I mean, taking that action is a good first step. Is that fair?
That's right. And you know, I mean, people can, it really helps people to sort of survey the landscape and figure out, okay, in my area, in my state, in my town, who is paying attention to this stuff? So there are groups out there that are carefully tracking these issues, and you know, whether you're the kind who wants to sort of join the Sierra Club or some other environmental group, or if you just want to get on a mailing list and pay attention, but there are ways to be alerted. Like, you know, the Public Utilities Commission is not making decisions every day, right, on the latest right. application from Power Company X. That happens at a certain time. It happens every couple of years. So you need to know when those occasions are and when the issue has been opened for public comment. And then it's just not that hard. I mean, these days, you know, if you want to make a comment, you don't even necessarily have to drive to the state capitol. You can do it over, you know, a video call, right?
I mean, let me just, as a personal experience, let me just say to your point, is that in Massachusetts, there is a current effort to revamp the building code, and Massachusetts Climate Action Network had taken the lead in providing, you know, talking points and simple letters that you could submit, and to try and have enough letters submitted to the what's called the DOER, the Department of Energy Resources, right, in order to establish the fact that the citizens want a clean building code. They may not understand all the details, but they want a clean building code. And you're quite right. It's easy enough. It's an email, and you send it off, and you have the satisfaction of taking action. But you don't kid yourself that you know everything about exactly what a building code has to be, right?
Right, right, exactly.
I got a slightly different question. Tell me this. In the most recent... In the climate bill, most recent, the big climate bill up that just passed in Washington, there's a lot of talk about a side deal that allows the Mountain Valley Pipeline and other terrible things, leasing and stuff, to go forward. Right? That's kind of this whack-a-mole game that climate activists are in, where they keep seeing new infrastructure being built and have to stop it. And that's in contrast to positive, constructive things that could be done, like buying new electric school buses. I mean, where do you guys come down on recommending how, you know, which side of the aisle should people choose? Should people oppose construction? I mean, there's probably 1,000 examples of things that shouldn't be built that are in your hometown versus positive things that result in a chain, you know, a new school. Do you have any sense of that after having done all your research?
Hal should answer this question for you, because his shop did the math on how much more carbon that bill produces versus how much it saves.
Okay.
Yeah, so we found that this bill creates 24 units of what should I maybe call negative carbon abatement for every single unit of new carbon supply. So 24-1 ratio of good to bad. That said, you know, it's a little painful to see some of the things that were tucked into that bill, but welcome to Washington.
Right.
I would say 24-1 is a pretty great ratio. I think as a rule, we have to do both. Think of the situation in Europe right now where Putin has his war of aggression against Ukraine. The European governments have to keep the lights on. No government survives blackouts. Mm-hmm. That's the end of your job. It's the end of your party's work. So you have to simultaneously avoid blackouts and avoid the destruction of climate change. And you have to do it without the safety blanket of Russian gas. Now, there are feasible ways to do both, but not if you make the wrong decisions. The margins for error are very small. So you really have to accelerate renewables deployment. You have to manage the grid quite differently. And you use fossil sparingly as a balancing device. Use your coal and your oil and your natural gas as a balancing device. And by the way, we face the same question in the United States. If you look at price inflation, that was caused by primarily by energy price inflation. If you look at, we spent $158 billion last year on disaster recovery. So America is nowadays always under some sort of drought or flood or fire. We're facing emergencies in America too, even though we have all this domestic natural gas and domestic oil. So we are, the point I'm trying to make here is this is a moment of choice. Where we, whether we now pursue a clean energy future, i.e. do the positive things that you're discussing here, or say no to the dirty. And the truth is we need to do both. And we need to make sure that all new capital investment goes to clean technologies, or at least on a 24-to-1 ratio.
Mm-hmm. Well, I that makes sense to me. I guess I wanted to come back to the question of green citizenship, right? Which I think is a great concept. And maybe ask you to explain, how do you see, well, as you know, let me first say that, as you are probably well aware, in climate circles, there's a sort of this debate, intellectual debate about private personal actions versus systemic change, you know, where you, can you perhaps talk about green citizenship in the sense of balancing the private action solar panel on my roof versus the systemic change of speaking to the DPU and the Public Utility Commission, and maybe how those things interact with each other? Does one drive the other, or do you think that's a good thing, or do you think that we only need to worry about personal action versus systemic action?
Well, look, green citizenship, this is what we're calling for, is a citizenship aimed at creating systemic action. You know, I mean, we're just not going to get where we need to go. We're not going to cut emissions enough and, you know, come anywhere close to meeting our climate goals if all we've got is, you know, a handful of conscientious citizens, you know, trying to do their best. I mean, even if that were to grow to become 5 or 10% of the whole citizenry, and we're nowhere near that right now, I don't think, actually, it's just not enough. And so we're trying to leverage the power of citizenship to create systemic change so that the economy begins to be cleaned up, even for those people who aren't paying any attention at all and just don't care, or maybe even actively oppose it. You want them to have a clean economy too, right? So this is all about systemic action. I do think, I mean, it's a false dichotomy to sort of say systemic, you know, green citizenship versus green consumerism, right? We do need both. And we specifically talk in the book about places where we think green consumerism may be really helpful. For example, in the food supply, we think consumers are sending a really important signal right now, as they kind of welcome the advent of, you know, Beyond Beef and the Impossible Burger and all that. And, you know, we see the marketplace beginning to create real alternatives to eating meat, eating beef in particular. And we desperately need those alternatives because beef is the costliest food we eat in terms of greenhouse gases. So we're definitely not saying there's no role for consumer action. We think there is. We think companies need to hear from their customers that they want those companies to pursue, you know, emissions cuts and a clean economy. The two things need to work together. But what we are saying is the green citizenship part has been really missing. And, you know, the public has been sort of MIA here, missing in action. Not entirely, but to too great of a degree. And so the book is an attempt to sort of goose people and get them out of their chairs and get them down to City Hall, you know, making these arguments.
I can't, you know, there's also when you are making the arguments, it's good to have an ethical parallel, right? It's easier for me having put solar on my roof and driving an electric car and having a heat pump in my house, it's easier for me to, I don't know, I feel good about the green citizenship. It feels consonant. But Justin's exactly right on the point. It's the intervention, the advocacy, that's going to turn, that's going to have a lot of zeros on it. The house is good. Getting the country right is even better.
Tell me again, remind me of the name of the book, where people can find it if they want to buy it.
Book is The Big Fix.
Go ahead, yeah. Justin.
The Big Fix, 7 Practical Steps to Save Our Planet, goes on sale September the 20th. Simon & Schuster is the publisher, and people will be able to get it anywhere. Your local bookstore can get it. If they don't have it in stock, they can certainly order it. You can go on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any site of your choice right now and pre-order the book. People will be able to get it as an audiobook if they want. And we hope eventually a paperback, but right now just a hardback. So, it will not be hard to find.
What we will do is put up a link to I've got the Simon & Schuster site, already. We'll put that, at least that, with perhaps some others, into the blog where the live links will be, and that'll be on the Mass Climate Action Network site. So if you're going to go to massclimateaction.org, look for newsletter and more on the banner, pull it down, it says blog and podcast, and in there you'll find these hot links. Or you can type, I'm sure you can just Google the Big Fix, Simon & Schuster, and you'll find it as well. But it'll be there, and that's good. If you have any comments or questions about future shows, things that we ought to be talking about next time around, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what's important to you. You, of course, can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using any one of the modern podcast distribution apps like Stitcher, Podbean, Apple, Google, blah, blah, blah. We're there. Just Google Climate Minute. Searching it with Mass Climate Action in the name. We want to thank our friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as green citizens to speak out. We must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So the book is The Big Fix. And Hal Harvey and Justin Gillis are the authors. They've been talking to us for this time about the book. I recommend that you take a look at it. Hal, Justin, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. Really appreciate it.
That's great. Well, thanks to everyone for being here. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.